This is Emotional Connection with Raphael Kushner. It's my personal and professional passion to help people access their emotions directly. This simple but rare process, for those who master it, provides greater wisdom, success, and most of all, well-being. Each week on this podcast, I share a recent session recorded with a client facing a particular challenge. This gives you, the listener, a chance to see the process of emotional connection in an up-close, unedited fashion, applied to practical, everyday concerns. Whenever you get the gist of the issue at hand and want to dive into the process itself, feel free to skip ahead in the podcast. For more information on this work, please visit my website, livingthequestions.org. This is also where you can reach me to ask questions and provide feedback, schedule your own private session by phone, get listings of upcoming events in your area, and learn about our unique year-long program. Once again, that's livingthequestions.org. This week, our sponsor is Podcast Potpourri. This is a quality program of unique, original, and sometimes beyond the norm topics. It can be heard at podcastfromtheheart.com, one of the podcasting channels on Yaktivate, where this podcast also originates. Podcast Potpourri is updated weekly and includes an interesting array of guest speakers, from psychics to teachers to authors to healers, as well as ordinary people making a big difference in the world. You can listen at podcastfromtheheart.com anytime, any day, online, or download it to your podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, and now, enjoy Emotional Connection. Hello, and welcome back. We are here today with Goomba. Welcome. Thanks for coming on and doing this.
You're welcome. Thank you for doing it. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. We were just chatting before our recording began about the fact that it's probably over 7 years ago that we connected with each other in San Francisco, so it's great to be able to touch base again, although it is a sad time, at least from what I've heard so far from Goomba. So if you would, it would be great just to kind of start off by describing the situation, you know, that you've been living with and feeling into, and just kind of ramble a little bit about, you know, where the challenges are, what it's been like, and you don't have to worry about it all fitting together real nicely. I'll ask you some follow-up questions, and I think we'll get to the heart of the matter, you know, in short order.
Okay, I'll start by saying that I lost my partner, Scott, who I was with for 7 years. I've known him for like almost 8 years, but we lived together for 7 years. And he passed away on July 23rd of this year. Mm-hmm. And it's the hardest thing that I've ever had to face in my life because it was unexpected. Scott had hepatitis B, mm-hmm. and he's had it for some time now. I found out that he had it like in 2003, mm-hmm. and that's when he found out he had it. But it had been dormant for all this time. And in fact, less than 6 months ago, he had a liver biopsy and everything was fine. So he wasn't on any type of antiviral medication or anything. Mm-hmm. Towards the beginning of July, I did what's called a master cleanse, which is some people call it a lemonade diet. Mm-hmm. It consists of drinking organic lemons, organic maple syrup, and spring water, and some cayenne pepper. And the fast goes for 7 days, and you drink this this concoction for like six times a day, and that's it's supposed to cleanse your system of toxins. And mm-hmm. it's been around for like 40 or 50 years, this diet, and mm-hmm. I learned it through. I've taken Tai Chi at my gym, and I learned it. My Tai Chi teacher was doing it, and I asked him about it, and he told me about it. And I went to the store and got a book on it, and decided to do it. And I did the master cleanse myself, and I did well on it. And Scott saw that I was doing well, and he said, well, I'm going to try it too. Mm-hmm. So he, when I finished my 10 days, he started his 10 days, and he went on the Master Cleanse. And towards the end of the Master Cleanse, he started, well, when he broke the fast of the Master Cleanse, he started getting pains in his digestive system. And he thought that maybe he broke the fast too quickly. And so he went to see his nurse practitioner at Kaiser, and she gave him something for his digestion and also took a blood test. And the symptoms continued, and the nurse practitioner called up and said that his liver enzymes had were elevated. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, I kept taking him to Kaiser to get blood work done like every other day, and the enzymes just kept elevating. Mm-hmm. And within a week after that, I took him to the emergency at Kaiser, and he was admitted to Kaiser, and he was in Kaiser Hospital for a day, and then they rushed him to UC Medical Center, where he was in intensive care for 8 days, and then he passed away. Mm-hmm. So it was a shock. There was no inkling that when I took him to the hospital that he wouldn't be coming back. Mm-hmm. And so all the time when he was in intensive care, we both were asking the doctors, could this diet have anything to do with it? And all of the doctors said that they don't see anything in the diet that could possibly create this. Mm-hmm. That sometimes the hepatitis B just kicks in. And anyway, it looked like cause and effect, and I felt terrible guilt about it. I felt had I not done the diet, then Scott wouldn't have done the diet. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I felt responsible for his doing the diet and ultimately responsible for his dying. Mm-hmm. And not only did I feel responsible for it, but his mother, whom I've been friendly with for all these 7 years, and that she accused me of killing him. Mm. So not only did I lose Scott, but then his mother accused me of killing him, said she never wanted to have anything to do with me, and held a memorial, and I wasn't even allowed to be at the memorial. Mm. So I was devastated, and it's been tough from that point on. I managed to get together friends and neighbors and coworkers, and I held a memorial myself for him at Crissy Field, which is in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And that was Scott's favorite place in the world. So mm-hmm. I held a memorial there and had closure that way. Mm-hmm. But since then, I've just been, I don't know, it just comes in waves. Mm-hmm. The grief just comes in waves. You know, I the only solace that I have is that I have the gratitude that I was with him for those 7 years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's the only positive spin I can put on it.
Yeah. So as you were describing this series of events, it brought up the fact that it isn't just a kind of straightforward grief that you're experiencing, because the grief is mixed in with some other emotions.
Guilt and blame and shame and all of it, yes.
Right, right. And so, you know, I really feel for you. It's just a incredibly painful time. I can hear that, and I can feel into it as well. And before we, you know, look a little closer, I just want to check in with you and see, you know, how have you been approaching the emotional part of your healing journey, you know, up until now? What has that looked like for you?
How have I been the emotional part of it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I understand that.
I'll give you some examples, and then you'll really understand what I mean. You know, some people do their best to push it away. Other people get busy. as a distraction. Other people just decide they're going to go for it and be with the painful experiences 100%. So how what is your – and usually it's a combination. So.
Yeah, it's a combination of all of those. For the most part, while Scott was sick or and when he was in intensive care, I just didn't do any alcohol or drugs or anything. I just wanted to be 100% there.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, well, first of all, as far as my emotions are concerned, anytime somebody would express condolence to me or be mm-hmm. compassionate to me, the only thing I could do in response is to cry, is to be with it, to let whatever come out. I really felt like I couldn't. Yeah, I mean, there are parts of me were saying, yeah, you got to snap out of it, you got to pull yourself together, but then I really didn't have any control over that for in the very beginning of that. And for the most part, my intention is to honor it and to honor the grief and just to be there with it and to honor it. There were two times, once when I went to a party that a neighbor had, mm-hmm. and then I drank too much wine, and then there were once or twice when I went up to Sebastopol, which is north of San Francisco, and to my closest friends and drank too much beer. Mm-hmm. There was like about three occasions since then, but other than that, I have been keeping busy,
mm-hmm.
and I have been keeping busy, but I have not been reading the newspapers. I have not been watching hardly any TV or watching the news on TV. I've been just trying to be present, and I've been reading spiritual books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading a book on awareness by Anthony DiMello.
Mm-hmm.
I read a book on non-duality by David Karras called Brilliant Perfect Stillness, and mm-hmm. I've been seeing a therapist once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then starting October 11th, I'm going to be joining a gay man's bereavement group,
mm-hmm.
which will go on for, I believe, 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the ways that I've been dealing with it. When Scott moved in with me, he had a dog, a Manchester Terrier. She was 2 years old. Now she's going on 10 years old, and she's... She keeps me real busy, too, because the two of us used to take care of her, and now it's just on me, and she's high maintenance, and she has all kinds of allergies and stomach troubles, and so that also keeps me busy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that's about it. I don't have a job. I've been retired, so I don't have a job, so I just thank God I don't, because I don't know where I'd find the time to do everything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So... You know, it's really clear from what you've been sharing that you've really had a strong intention to stay present and connected to yourself, and this passage that you're moving through, you've sought out a lot of support in different ways. You've been, you know, very wise about that, and you, you know, there were a few times, like you said, where, you know, you checked out, but that's perfectly understandable over a period of months. You know, none of us are meant to be perfect in our grief. As a matter of fact, there's no such thing as perfect grieving. That would probably be too somehow stilted and controlled if we tried. So what about that process, you know, as you reflect on it now and as you just be with your own experience in this moment, what about that process is the most challenging for you? Where are you feeling like your support system, you know, isn't touching the pain, or somehow that there's, you know, something that additionally could be brought to the situation to be helpful? Where does that show up?
I'm not sure if this is the right answer, but, you know, there are, like, the most difficult times for me are, like, on weekends when mm-hmm. Scott and I used to do a lot of things together.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning it was, you know, every night, every evening where about the time he would come home from work or just going, still haven't been able to empty his closet or anything or stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. And
mm-hmm.
Just living just constantly living here with a reminder of our relationship together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I'm answering the question or not, but can you?
Yeah, no, you're doing great. I'm just wondering if there are times when you feel that, and you started to address this, times that you feel like, you know, you can't handle it or, you know, something's wrong, as opposed to this is a really hard time and you wish it weren't happening, but you're doing your best to stay present and to honor it, and it's not supposed to be different, even though, you know, it's so painful.
Well, yeah, I wish it was different, but it's not. I know it's not. It can't be. So not that I don't wish it wasn't, but I do. I wish God were still with me, but I know that that's not a possibility. And I experience anger at times.
Mm-hmm.
At first, it was anger at his mother because of the way she treated me, and.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was also anger at myself, and also I experienced shame about my grief. It was like I've been going to this satsang on Monday nights. This local guy, John Byrne, is an ex-Buddhist monk, and he has satsang every Monday night. I went there, and I was sharing there, and the thought arose in me, and I realized that I was ashamed of my grief. I was ashamed to talk about it. You know, it's like my mind is saying, snap out of it, you know, you should be over it. You know, it's like, you know, men are not supposed to cry, all of those.
How long ago was that satsang group?
That was just this past Monday.
Okay. So, you know, that's really exactly what I was asking about and wondering about, because on the one hand, you've brought a lot of presence and support to your grieving process. And then if I hear you right, on the inside, you're often a little bit uneasy with that process. So, you know, there's one part of you that wants to be with the grief, and then another part of you that feels like you're not supposed to, or there's something wrong with you for having it.
Yeah, or I'm going to alienate my friends, or I'm going to, you know, be too needy, or...
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's perfectly understandable too, and you know, a very universal experience that we have strong emotions and then we also judge them in one way or another. We judge them as lasting too long or being too intense or pushing people away or else just comparing them to some standard that we've either been taught or that we've absorbed from the culture or that we've decided that we want to live up to. So it seems like from what you're saying that there's a part of you that's often around watching you experience your grief kind of with a clipboard in its hand, evaluating, you know, how you're doing and where you're falling short and, you know, how far you're straying from some ideal, you know, as to how it's supposed to go.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So one of the principles in the work that, you know, I do with people is that, you know, we don't ever want to create self-opposition. We want to move forward from a place of self-acceptance, and that means that, you know, if you and I were to sit here and say, wow, that part of you that judges yourself, you know, for having your grief, that needs to go, and that's not helpful. And when you experience that, you need to push that away. You know, we would be meeting resistance with resistance, you know, and therefore just creating additional resistance. So, you know, this approach goes the opposite direction and says, okay, well, let's check into that place inside of ourselves that's resistant. Even before we go, you know, more fully into the emotional experience itself. So I'm curious, actually, without any judgment and without any pretense of understanding already, I'm interested in this part of you, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing just to kind of give it the floor a little bit. So when you notice those judging thoughts going through you, you've already said that, you know, they have the quality of, you know, snap out of it and you're going to lose your friends or you're too needy. But what else can you tell me about it? I mean, if we just start from the perspective of, you know, here it is September. It's only a couple months ago since you lost your life partner, and it was not only a great loss but a shocking loss as well. It had with it a lot of great complications, and so you're going through this difficult period of time and doing the best you can. So if we probe a little further and ask this part of you to, you know, reveal its truest thoughts, even if they're the most harsh and negative judgments, or even if they sound crazy, you know, what's wrong with you according to this part? You know, let it speak. Tell me, you know, everything it has to say about how you're not doing this right.
Oh, goodness. Well, first of all, men are not supposed to be emotional. That's one aspect of it.
Okay, so let's just pause there. So there is a part of you that, kind of carries that social conditioning that says that, you know, men are supposed to hold us together and they're not supposed to really feel or at least display their emotions. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And also, another part of it is like, I'm going to make somebody else feel uncomfortable if I'm, like when neighbors ask me how I'm doing, I always say, well, I'm okay. And sometimes I want to say, well, you know, I'm sad and I'm lonely and I miss Scott. And how would you feel, you know?
Yeah. So I want to talk about that second one, but I want to go back, you know, now to the first one. So, when you hear that judgment, or that, let's not even call it a judgment right now, let's call it an assessment. When you hear that assessment about the role of men in society and who they're supposed to be, and that they're not supposed to cry and that they're supposed to hold it together, first of all, do you identify with that a little, a lot, in between, you know, when you're witnessing that thought and you're not in it, what's your take on it?
Well, it's bullshit.
Okay, I'm wanting to check on that. So when you're not blindsided by the thought, you don't think it carries much weight. It doesn't seem to work for you.
No, it doesn't. I mean, okay. I wouldn't be true to myself if that was the case.
Okay. And when you hear that and when you experience that thought arising in you, does it connect to any individual or period or any part of your life? I mean, does it have the quality of anyone, or is it just more?
Well, yes. When I was a kid, if I was hurt in any way and I cried, I was called a crybaby.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what?
Yeah, so what you're saying is that it seems to stem from that training.
Right.
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 Okay.
Yeah.
And who was it?
Or
that
you're a crybaby or you're a sissy if you're sensitive.
Right. Right. And who was it that was primarily, you know, giving you that message?
Well, my family, my whole family.
Okay. And that
mother,
included
father, brothers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how, just, you know, kind of going back there with me for a second, I get that they really taught you that message. And how would you assess, I mean, we don't have to, you know, kind of go one by one into great detail, but how would you assess their overall emotional health and well-being back then? I mean, do you feel they were doing pretty well? Were they...
No, I think it was a very dysfunctional family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my father was an alcoholic and absent a lot of the time, and everything fell on my mother. And but I think it was just the whole Irish Catholic I don't know, macho men don't cry, boys,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you cry and you're a boy, you're a sissy. And
yeah. So have you ever heard the term, it's going to sound like a big word, but it's really not, the term introject?
Yes.
Okay. So what I'm getting when I hear how clearly you don't associate with that belief and yet it arises within you, what I'm getting is that, you know, it really is an introject. It's something, you know, of your family, particularly your parents, and that you know, really landed inside of you and lives inside of you to this day as a kind of a, you know, almost like, let's say, like a vapor trail of their experience. It's there inside of you. And you recognize that, you know, that they were not particularly happy or particularly successful at dealing with their own emotional experience. And so I'm wondering, in your own healing journey so far in life, where are you in terms of those key players from early on? Have you found, an accommodation, a peace with them? Are you still angry at them? You know, what would you say about that?
It's like when I said it's bullshit, you know, that's bullshit earlier, you know, it was like my intellectual understanding of it knows that it's bullshit, but like you say, I interjected it and it's still, emotionally, it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, in many ways, I made peace with my parents. I realized they're both deceased now, and in fact, three of my older brothers are deceased too. And I made peace knowing that they were all doing the best that they could with what they were given.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that, you know, there's a sense of forgiveness there, but yet there's still, like you say, an emotional vapor of it all there.
Yeah. So in relation to that first thought about, you know, men don't cry, suck it up, when that thought arises, I'm wondering if it might work for you to, first of all, just notice it as soon as you can, and the noticing, of course, separates you from it, which is very different from either pushing it away, which doesn't work, just creates more resistance, as we said, and really bonds you to it, or, you know, gripping onto it as in, you know, that's the truth, and now all of a sudden you're attached with it and off and running. But if you just notice it and turn toward it with your attention, then it also may be possible, given the work you've done, to be really compassionate of that aspect of yourself, you know, that vapor trail that exists and really carries forward their energy or their spirit. In other words, you know that they were doing the best they can, but also it was pretty challenging sometimes to be them, and they didn't have some of the tools that you have. And, you know, with that recognition and the recognition that this thought is really their legacy, I'm wondering if you can approach that thought when it arises with compassion. You know, like, wow, I get it. That's a heavy thought. That's a thought that really stops the whole healing from happening. It's very painful. It arose in my consciousness. I didn't choose it to come up. Here it is. And now, as a vestige of those people, their pain, their role in my life, here's another opportunity just to say, yeah, I hear it. I get it. I'm going to stay really present for that. I'm going to bring my loving energy to this thought that has arisen and is kind of wanting to pull me into its own suffering.
So you're asking me if I can witness the thought, and
yeah, the first thing I'm asking you is if you can witness the thought.
Uh-huh.
That's pure and simple. And
yeah.
Then the second thing I'm asking you is, could you witness it in a gentle and compassionate way? Like you would if a really close friend, or, you know, even before he passed on, if Scott, you know, was having a troubling time or was really in pain, you know, and you would just listen, and you would also listen with care and he could feel your attentive, caring listening, and that would be soothing to him. And I'm asking you if you could bring that same quality of attention to the thought itself.
Well, I'm willing to, if that's possible. That would be wonderful.
Okay, so I would just encourage you to experiment with that, you know, just because the witnessing itself almost gets you all the way home, because as soon as you're noticing that you're having the thought that, you know, men aren't supposed to have emotions, you're not identified anymore with the thought. So that witnessing itself can create some space and some peace for you. And then if you can add the compassionate part, you're actually going to even add some healing in that very moment. So, yeah, give it a try and see how that goes. And, you know, we can talk about it more, you know, as you practice. But you know, let it be an experiment. And, you know, if you aren't able to do that, if somehow the thought derails you or you feel too much anger or upset towards the thought, that's really important, too. Just notice that. So let it be an experiment in the sense that you're going to try to meet that thought with compassion, and know that whatever happens isn't wrong or bad or a mistake. It's all part of a learning process. Okay. So that's one piece of, you know, what I wanted to share with you. Now, the second thing that you shared, let's come back to that. Can you state that again? You said, you know, I shouldn't have the emotion. And then you added another piece. Do you remember it, or are you like me, so into what we were just talking about?
Well, I kind of...
It dropped out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe it will come back as we talk about it. But is there anything else, you know, that comes up with some kind of clarity or regularity from this, you know, judging consciousness, any other, you know, point of view, any other accusation that it wants to
make?
Well,
the accusation that I'm responsible for Scott doing the diet, and that I'm responsible for him, actually, for him dying.
So, okay, would you say then that even though it's all your kind of murky interior and we can't, you know, draw clear lines of distinction, but would you say that that in general, the part of you that judges you for having emotion feels like either the same or in close proximity to the part of you that judges you for what happened to Scott? I mean, does it kind of feel the same? Is there a
yeah,
quality?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's definitely, yeah.
Okay. So, now, I asked you about the first thought, you know, what do you think of it when you separate from it and you're just noticing it? And you were honest as you were saying that, you know, intellectually you knew that it was BS, but, you know, then there's still the vapor that's left, the emotional imprint, so to speak. What about with that thought? When you separate from that and look at it, how do you...
That's more difficult because it looks so much like cause and effect to me that it's hard to, even though the doctors say that, my mind comes back, well, what do they know? You know, how can they be sure?
Let me ask you a really, you know, kind of basic question about that. Can you be sure that it was cause and effect?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you really have no way of knowing that?
No.
Okay. So when the part of you that judges and says it's your fault arises, I would, you know, suggest that you also witness that thought, that you turn to it with as much, you know, gentleness and openness as the first thought we were talking about, but also... just, you know, kind of add this piece. It wouldn't necessarily need to be in words, but the piece is just, yeah, I get it. You know, it's easy to feel responsible, and I get that you're feeling responsible, and I don't want to change your mind. Don't want to tell you that you're wrong. I'm just noticing that this is a situation in which there's no way to actually know the truth about that question in either direction, yes or no, or partially. There's just no way to know. So it's not meeting that thought with a debate. It's meeting that thought with acceptance, but also just kind of a reminder that it's not actually even a question for which there's an answer. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
It makes sense. And then,
let's just say, let's keep going. Let's just say that you did do that. Do you sense that there would be a pushback, you know, from that part of you, or that's the end of the temporary conversation right there?
Well, in the past, there was always a pushback when I tried to rationalize it, or you know, like I would say, even if it were true, and I talked Scott into this diet, I mean, Scott did not do anything that he didn't want to do. I mean, Scott had a strong will of his own, and he would not have done anything that he didn't want to do. So, I mean,
You would rationalize like that, what would the pushback be from the judgmental side?
It would just say, well, had he never met you, then he would have been introduced to the diet, so then he wouldn't have even had the opportunity to know about the diet. It's like a loop.
So there's a lot to this process, and I don't want to oversimplify it or, you know, insult the depth of it. But, you know, there's a way in which this is an internal conversation, and, you know, one part of you wants to find peace and healing, and another part of you just really hates that you're having to feel this way, and even more so, hates that you lost Scott. And so that part of you only knows how to blame, find fault. You know, we talked before about, you know, how very early on you experienced that introject of, you know, boys don't cry. Well, also, it's a very young kind of behavior, you know, to feel bad and look for who to blame. But even though it's young, it's something that can easily be stimulated in us at any age. You know, for instance, if you're working with a really close friend and you're, you know, building something in your yard, and one of you is holding the nail and the other is hitting the hammer, and the person slips and hits your hand, the first thing that happens is you say, ow, and you feel the pain. And the next thing is you turn to that person who you know did it by accident and say, well, why did you do that? You know, or even if you don't say that, that's the feeling like, get away from me. You know, you hurt me. So it was an accident, and you know that. But because you're hurt, you go to that place temporarily until the hurt eases. And so this part of you, you know, the one that says, yeah, but, and wants to figure out how to pin it on you no matter what, actually feels like, you know, it wouldn't have to hurt so much if someone else could take the blame. But instead of it being your friend outside of you, this is an internal conversation between one part of you and another part of you. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So it's a natural process. It's something that's going to happen inside of you, just like, you know, if your friend hit your finger with a hammer. And again, you can meet that with awareness and compassion. Yeah, I get it. This is awful, and it really feels like it might be better if some other part of me could just take the blame and suck it up and be punished for how bad you're having to feel right now. And in that process, what you're doing is you're not attaching to either part, you know, the part that's supposed to feel the pain or the part that's looking for someone to blame to take the pain away. You're removed into this witnessing place, and you're really watching what's happening, you know, in a caring way. And that, just like the first experience we were talking about, I think will give you some space to not be so pulled down by that drama. Does that sound like something you could try?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So those were so you mentioned that in the past you would get pushback when you tried to do the rational analysis, and I think that mostly what I want to share with you about that is that part of you, even if it seems like it, isn't really in a place to debate. That's why that compassionate awareness is going to, I think, settle the stormy waters when that arises, when that kind of thought arises, much more than the debate. Because after you've just been hit by a hammer, it's going to take a while for you to say, yes, I know, I had my finger there, and we didn't have enough coordination, and, you know, it was completely an accident, and I don't have any, you know, ill feeling about it. You're not at that place yet inside of yourself. It's still too raw. You are still just hit by that hammer. But you're not in that place right now. And so I want to ask you, when you do rationalize, or when you have rationalized it in the past, is there any part of you that doesn't believe, like that thought, when you were trying to debate with the blaming part of you, that thought says there's no way that you could have known this, that, you know, Scott is responsible for himself, et cetera. Is there any part of that thought process that you, when you're not, you know, in the pain of it and not in the blame of it, that you question? You know, I mean, from this distance, from this moment when you're not in that emotional state or that judging state, are you completely clear that you're not, quote, unquote, responsible, or are you unsure about that still?
Well, I can't absolutely know that I'm responsible. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean?
That's part of it. But do you feel again in this moment of openness, as you look at the situation and with your willingness to witness what arises, do you notice that you feel even partly responsible?
I think I haven't let go of that yet.
Mhm. Mhm. Okay. And so
there's no, like, right now there's no emotional charge to it, but there's still it's having an intellectual understanding and not really feeling it.
Right. Intellectually, it feels like, no, I'm not responsible, but you're trying to be really honest and authentic, and you're saying there's still these waves in me, these ripples that say, well, yeah, to some degree, I have to be responsible.
Right.
Okay, so I really honor that. And before I was talking about the path of acceptance as opposed to resistance, and, you know, I'm going to share something with you now that comes from that path. And it's going to sound alarming at first, but it goes completely in the opposite direction, which is to say, yes, you know, you are partly responsible, and so am I, and so is everyone, because, you know, I know that you've been paying attention to what we call non-dual spirituality. It's been a part of your path, and, you know, we all give such lip service to how we're all interconnected, and how there really is no separation between us when we pay close attention. So therefore, there's some involvement in everything that we all share, whether it's local or non-local. And, you know, I'm responsible for many things that I don't even ever get a chance to see. I can't connect the dots. You know, I pay tax dollars to the U.S. government that fund a war in Iraq. So I'm responsible to some degree, you know, for the death of innocent civilians. And, you know, we could go on and talk about the ways that each of our actions in the world are part of this whole, you know, to use this word without specificity, this whole kind of karmic map of, you know, what the Buddhists call dependent origination. Everything happens as a result of everything else. So in that sense, you are responsible. And then at the same time, the part of you that feels responsible is claiming a different kind of personal and direct culpability for which somehow you should be held accountable. Right? I mean, that's the difference.
I get it. I get what you're saying. If I'm not the doer, I'm not responsible.
You are and you're not. You are in the way that you are a part of this dance of all that is.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you're not in the sense that you did not knowingly take any actions that were meant to cause harm to anybody else.
And you could say that about anybody.
You could, and yet we live in a society, you know, which holds people accountable. And then the question becomes, what are you accountable for? Right? So if you harm someone unintentionally, you still may have to, you know, pay a price for it because, you know, it was, let's say if it was murder, it was, you know, manslaughter as opposed to, you know, premeditated murder. That's, you know, at an extreme. But also, if you break a law in our society and you don't know you broke the law, you're still responsible for paying the price. So there are lots of situations where we assess culpability and then we also attach some kind of penalty for that culpability based on people's behavior. But in this situation, you followed a health regimen, you know, for your own well-being. And Scott saw that and wanted to experience that well-being for himself. He had a clean bill of health from his practitioners. Nobody suggested that there was anything that he should do in terms of, you know, diet or exercise was a part of this protocol. So he had no indication that it would have a negative effect on him. You didn't. And then this, you know, tragic accident occurred, whether or not it was connected, you know, to the fast or not. So there was no, there was a series of events that happened that led to his, you know, sickness and passing. But you as an individual, either with intention or without intention, didn't do anything that you know about that had the cause and effect. In other words, you look at it from the situation and you say, well, cause and effect, I did this and he did that and then he died. And that's what I'm talking about as a part of, you know, the dance of all that is. You know, if, you know, when I was little, my father was taking us on a drive through a park and a little boy stepped out into the street. And, you know, my dad hit the boy with a car, and the boy ended up having some injury and ultimately was okay. My dad felt terribly guilty, but the truth of the matter is the boy was lower than the fender of the car, so my dad never saw the boy. So is my dad responsible, you know, in the sense that he was driving the car and he hit the boy? Yes. Was he responsible in the sense that, you know, there was a car, there was a driver, and there was a boy? Yes. But was he responsible in a way that he should be held accountable for, that he should be blamed for? That's a different question. So I guess what I'm asking you to consider is that you could get off the wheel of blame by saying, yeah, a number of things happened that led to this tragic event. And you could parse that forever to try to figure out to what degree you're responsible and you should punish yourself. Or you could just say that everything is connected to everything else. So in that sense, there is a connection. But there was nothing that I did willfully or even unintentionally that really, to my knowledge, created this. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And And as you hear that and you just like turn your attention to your body and you let it settle in, do you notice any yeah but from any part of you that arises?
At the present moment, no.
Okay.
No.
So that's the right answer, because the next moment it may arise, or tonight it may come back up in you, you know, a different way. You have no way of knowing. But my suggestion or my invitation to you is that when that thought comes up again, because let's say most likely it will, rather than walking through the somewhat rational process that I just walked through with you, rational although non-dual, coming from that spiritual perspective of wholeness, I think it'd be much easier for you to just say, I know, it's true. I'm responsible to some extent, and to the extent that I'm responsible, it breaks my heart. I get it. And then notice how you feel as you open to that sense of responsibility. And rather than, you know, creating more resistance, move through that. Accept that, see that clearly for what it is, the fact that a part of you feels responsible and you're going to just be with that 100%. And as I mentioned before, we're all responsible for all kinds of things. And whenever we, you know, guilt ourselves into a place of self-blame or recrimination, it doesn't help the problem. In other words, for me, if the thought arises that I am directly, not even indirectly, but directly responsible for the deaths of innocent civilians and soldiers as well in Iraq because I keep paying my tax dollars and some of those tax dollars go to defense, if I stay with the idea like either, yeah, but, you know, I oppose the war or, you know, yeah, but there's nothing I can do, if I get into an engagement with an argument with that thought, it's not going to make me a better anti-war activist. It's only going to keep me locked in a contracted state. And similarly, if you try to argue your way out of that feeling of responsibility and blame, it's going to do the same for you. And, you know, really, the loss here is that you had such a deep love and connection with Scott and a deep acceptance of one another. So, you know, what is the legacy that that love can bring here? It's the opposite of the legacy that we talked about earlier from your childhood. You know, can you meet those parts of you that are blaming and judging with the same, in the same way that you met Scott lovingly and that he met you? That's really the question.
Well, that is a, you know, before I answer that question, let me just say something else, and it's something that his mother said to me. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it made me question my sanity for a minute. She said, you killed my son with that crazy diet. You told him that that would cure his hepatitis B. Now, I never remember ever saying anything like that to Scott, anything. Mm-hmm. But once she said that, my mind started saying, could I have said that? Could that be true? And that, I think that is something that has fed my guilt all the way up to this point. And it's like I don't ever recall ever saying that to him. Mm-hmm. And yet, where did she get that from?
Right, right. And of course, I have no idea where she got it from. But again, from what I know of you, even, let's just say you didn't say it, but even if in some parallel universe you did say it, I really doubt you would have said it that way. You know, I mean, you maybe would have said something like, I wonder if this could have a positive effect on your hepatitis B.
Right. Okay.
And also, you know, the truth is that there wasn't anything really to cure at that point. He wasn't suffering any ill effects of the hepatitis
right.
B. So what did it really matter if he cured his hepatitis
uh-huh.
B? Now, I'm giving you, you know, rational answers to your questions, because what you're saying is, okay, I get what you're saying, Raphael, about how to meet this thought with acceptance. But I've got to tell you, like, what if I am more directly responsible? What then, right? And so that's why I'm addressing, you know, your concerns in this way. And I would go one step further and say that, you know, I have a chronic illness, and me personally, and if somebody said, you know, you should do X, I think that's going to cure your chronic illness, I might say to myself, well, I'll try it and see what happens. But also I might say, you know, that seems, I don't know, like I want to check first. I want to talk to one of my caregivers to see, you know, is there any possibility here that I could have a negative effect as well as a positive one. So had you said something like that, you know,
right,
my guess is that Scott also would have, you know,
right,
checked
and he read the same literature on it that I read about the diet. So I mean, there's that part of it too.
Right. So yeah. So I know you wanted to bring that up because what we're talking about wouldn't really impact you in as full a way if you were holding on to this thought. You know, wait a minute though, I did do something directly. And so it's good we address that. And now let's come back to the other. You said you were going to address that in a minute.
Okay.
Do you remember the other part you were going to address, or should I?
Well, you said, can I meet those thoughts or accusations that arise with the same acceptance and love that I would have for Scott?
Yeah, or that he would have had for you, you know, at your best of times.
Uh-huh.
Is that a uh-huh, yes, I can, or
let me just think about that, if that's a possibility. I mean, that would be my desire.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my desire, yes. To,
okay.
Yeah.
So one of the things that maybe can also help in the situation for you is that, you know, when that thought arises that you're, you know, that you're guilty or you're responsible, it just arises. I mean, you don't have any control over it. It just pops into your consciousness like most thoughts do. And, you know, when you have other thoughts that, you know, arise saying, you know, well, I did the best I could, that, you know, that thought usually arises as well. The question is how you meet these thoughts. And what I'm suggesting in everything we've talked about so far is that you turn your attention to these thoughts and you are open to them and compassionate to them. And that's really actually the way that you experience oneness in yourself. You know, we were talking about the non-dual approach earlier, and a lot of people who might be listening to this at some point wouldn't even know what that was. But the simple way to describe it is that when you witness so closely whatever is your experience, there's a way that the witnesser and the experience become one. That's what we mean by non-dual. But you can only become one in that way when the quality of your witnessing is clear and open and compassionate. So what you're being called to experience in this really difficult passage is that is first of all through that practice, what you're sort of, it's a trial by fire. Can you stay aware and present and gently connected to the most painful and challenging of thoughts and experiences, you know, for yourself and for the greater good? Because this is how we wake up, is through that. And if it were any easier, then, you know, you wouldn't be able to have the opportunity here to take that great step, to meet yourself with a fuller degree of loving kindness, and then, you know, to wake up in such a way that you can serve others with that degree of loving kindness and power, really. And that would be the greatest gift you could come through this healing process with, and that would be the greatest memorial to Scott, as far as I'm concerned, you know, that you could love yourself and you could love these experiences through this difficult time so fiercely that as a result of it, your heart just broke open and you became a force for love and presence and healing in the world. You know, what better memorial could there be?
I can't think of one.
Okay. So, yes, that's what I'm asking. Can you meet every one of these thoughts that arise that want to pull you down into bad feeling, contracted states? Can you meet them with a full embrace and a real curiosity and openness? Can you come toward them, you know, and experience what's there in that moment fully? That's really what you're being called to do.
And that's what I would want to do. I really
right.
is. Now is can you just can you give me an example? Say that though. Give me an example on how to do that.
Okay, and we're going to do it in terms of these thoughts now, and then before we're done, we're going to turn to emotions as well. So, you know, I'm lying in bed and I'm trying to think. I'm trying to sleep. And, you know, I've closed my eyes and suddenly this image of Scott's mother comes into my mind. And I see her saying to me, you know, you killed my son and all those other things she said to you. And so the first thing that happens is I have some kind of overall physical contraction, right? And so, or even just a kind of a brain squint, you know, I just, ugh, that's a painful moment.
Or in some cases when that thought came, anger arises and wanting to attack her or strike back and say, well, you know, you killed
right.
him. Or
right, right. So either way, as soon as, you know, you're in that state, you notice a flash of anger or you notice, you know, a contraction of your overall energy, you're aware that it's arisen. And then you turn your attention either to the anger in that moment, if there's no anger, you turn your attention to, you know, the thought, which really isn't even there anymore, right? Because the thought arises and then it's gone. So all you've got left to turn your attention to is sort of the emanation of that thought and whatever else is left in your body-mind space. But you're looking with openness and gentleness, and that's your only job, that's your only activity, to notice everything that's there in the field of your consciousness without even searching for it. Just notice as you turn towards your experience with a witnessing gaze what is showing up for you to open to, for you to keep connected to with your attention. To be really clear, because this is like sometimes gossamer stuff, to be really clear, because you're asking for that clear instruction, this is about the practice of attention. It's about where you place your conscious focus. And when you are placing your conscious focus on the source of this contraction or the source of this flash of anger, you may find a cascade of more thoughts arise. You may find that nothing is there and just that turning of your attention has eased the moment. Or you may find suddenly that there's a pulling feeling in your stomach. But whatever your attention finds, then the next thing you want to do is just stay with that sensation. Follow it as if you're surfing on the wave, staying connected to it the same way that the surfboard is connected to the wave, and following it where it leads you. And where it leads you always is to a place of ease and expansion and healing, whether that happens in 10 seconds or 10 minutes. But your only job is just to stay with it in that gentle, attentive way. Does that sound clear?
It does sound clear, but the one question that comes up for me is like, how to do that without latching onto the thought, without it cascading into other thoughts or... Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. I'll tell you what my experience is, and that is that the minute that I'm aware of a thought in the way I just described, I can't latch onto it. The awareness cuts that connection. Because when you say latch on to it, it's what we mean by a train of thoughts. And on that train of thoughts, I'm going along and there is an unconscious fusion between myself and these thoughts, whether it's about, you know, what I should do tonight, you know, for dinner, or something, you know, as serious and painful as what we're talking about. There's a, when I said it was an unconscious fusion, what I mean is that the witness isn't present on that train of thought. It's not, it hasn't gone away from my field of awareness, but I'm not connected to the witness. But as soon as I'm aware that I'm having a train of thought, I'm not on the train of thought anymore. If I'll go back into the train of thought once again, a second later or 20 seconds later, it's just me back on the train. And as soon as I'm aware that I'm back on the train, I'm not on the train. Do you see what I'm saying?
I get you. It's kind of like when you repeat a mantra in meditation and all of a sudden you realize that your thoughts are elsewhere and you come back to the mantra.
Right. So all you're doing is you're coming back to the practice of compassionate attention. So what do you make of that?
I see, yes.
Yeah, okay. So we've talked a lot about the thoughts that are making it harder for you to just allow yourself to have this time. And, you know, the good news is that there isn't anything different about how to approach the actual grief itself. But this same practice, when applied to emotions, it slows down, it takes a little bit more time because emotions move through us more slowly. They're moving through our dense physical body as opposed to through those super fast electronic circuits of our brain. But that surfing is still exactly what it means to actually give yourself to the experience while still staying awake to it. You know, you said to me, I think before we started our recording today, that, you know, you came to that workshop many years ago and you said you remember that it was a Living the Questions workshop and you have my book, but you haven't really been practicing Living the Questions. Well, Living the Questions is just, you know, kind of a helpful way to remember how to do what it is that we've been talking about today. And when you do it, you are experiencing the grief, if grief is what's arising, as absolutely fully as you can with the greatest degree of acceptance that you can. And when that happens, you create the optimum environment for whatever emotion needs to move through you and to let go of you, to do so as quickly and easily as possible. And in a situation where there's a lot of grief, you know, it's not a kind of like, well, I do this one time and then it's over. We don't really want to have an end point in our mind, you know, like, you know, those interjects might say, well, you could cry for a day but get over it. Because the truth is, we never get to decide how long we feel anything. We only get to decide whether we resist it or accept it. So what we're talking about is what that acceptance looks like in action. And when you're willing to do that, not even all the time, because none of us are perfect at it, but when you're willing to do that for much of the time, you can have a deep faith that you are really allowing yourself to be as present and connected as possible to the experience, and know as a result that you will heal as fully as you can and as quickly as you can, and the rest of it is out of your hands. Does that make sense?
Yes. I'm nodding my head and you can't see that. Yes, it makes
sense. Okay. So the last thing that we need to do to make this complete is actually practice in the emotional realm, because it is a little different. It feels different. You know, it's physical. as opposed to the thinking realm, which sometimes is, as I said, you know, so quick, almost like, you know, electronic signals. So in this moment, if you just think of Scott and everything that's happened, just the huge array of loss and shock and surprise and anger and the whole thing, you just let yourself kind of settle into the enormity of what you've gone through and even what's still here in your life, in your consciousness as a result of this loss. And you turn your attention to your body. Where do you notice that your attention is drawn? Where's the greatest place of sensation?
Maybe around the eyes and the head.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So just allow yourself to do exactly that surfing I described. Let yourself feel whatever sensations are in your eyes or your head. Don't try to change them or make them go away. Don't cling to them. Try to keep them still. Don't even try to understand them. Just let your attention be open, gentle, and just surf the waves of those sensations wherever they take you. They could completely change. They could stay the same. But just notice them for a few quiet moments. See where they go. If any thoughts arise, just... go ahead.
Some mild sobbing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So see if you can just stay completely present in the same way to the mild sobbing. In other words, don't try to increase it or don't try to stop it. Just keep noticing it with this compassionate attention we've been talking about. Just for a few more moments, just keep letting it come and see where that takes you. Just a few more seconds, just stay with it. And even see if you can just kind of sink down into the heart of it. So your witnessing is from the inside of this experience. And so what do you notice?
Just a sigh and more of a feeling lighter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that maybe 15 or 20 seconds is really the heart of the matter. You know, if you can do that whenever you can, first of all, but especially whenever a big feeling overtakes you, whenever, you know, you feel like it's too much. Just surf in the way that you were just doing. And that surfing is really it's the deepest kind of self-love that you can offer. It's a way of saying, I don't like this feeling very much, probably. I don't even want it. And yet it's here. So I'm going to accept it, but not with a dry kind of distanced intellectual acceptance. I'm going to accept it up close and personal. I'm going to hold it like I would, you know, a baby that was completely inconsolable. I'm going to follow its every move, and I'm going to stay right there with it, noticing and noticing and noticing with an openness and a curiosity. That is how, you know, you love yourself in the deepest way. And in my experience, every time we do that, we create not just the optimum environment for the feeling to move through us, but also the optimum environment for healing to happen. So it's a gift that you give yourself, and it truly is a way to honor not just your loss, but also to honor Scott. It's a way for you to love ever more fully and to do it, you know, in real time when it's the most difficult to do.
I'm nodding my head again.
Okay. Okay. So just to bring everything together and conclude, when we began, you described a situation in which you had a lot of support and you were really giving yourself the space and time to grieve and get through this really difficult time. You also said that, you know, there were some impediments to that process. Mostly there were these internal voices that would arise, one saying, you know, you should snap out of it, you know, and another one saying you're responsible. And we talked a lot about those voices, but ultimately where we came to was that, you know, meeting them with this compassionate attention is the way to dissipate the pain and the resistance that they're causing within you, because, you know, a rational approach isn't actually going to do that. They're not coming from a rational place. So you're going to love them the way you wish you could have been loved as a child who was inconsolable. And in that process, you know, you're going to become more present. You're not going to get pulled down, you know, into an internal argument. And you're going to clear the space for whatever you need to feel in those moments. And then similarly, you know, you're doing a great job with the grief. And yet in those moments when, you know, you have to turn away from it or you're finding yourself judging it too much, bringing your attention to the emotional flow in the same way is all you need to do. And so really what we've talked about is how to take what you've already brought to the situation, which is so considerable and so moving, and just add a deeper level of acceptance, a deeper level of presence and accompaniment to your own experience, which is just going to sort of invigorate what you've already begun and allow you to be more at peace with the process, even when it's painful. And that's what I can actually point you towards, which is that I don't know when the pain is going to end, and I don't know how those waves are going to come and go and when they're going to be, you know, seeming overwhelming. But I do know from my own experience, as well as, you know, working with lots of people, that it's possible to have all of that pain and feel peaceful at the same time. It's not so possible to feel peaceful when these voices arise, these voices of judgment, blame, and recrimination, and we feel as if we have to sort of respond to them on their own level or beat them down or something like that. That's where we lose the peace. But it is possible to go through this next phase of your healing process, as painful as it may be, in a peaceful state.
I can see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good. I can see it.
So I would just encourage you to stay in touch with me, you know, if you have any questions. If there's like a refinement or a yeah, but pops up or what about this, feel free to email me. And even if something comes up that, you know, feels like it just can't be dealt with justice in an email, you know, you don't need to have a whole session, let's say, but hey, could we get on the phone for 5 or 10 minutes and just talk about this? I'd always be happy to do that.
Okay.
And before we close today, let me just ask, is there any question that's lingering in your mind about what we've discussed today that it would be good to get it out there right now? Or do you feel complete?
I feel complete right now.
Okay.
I do. Yes.
Excellent.
Thank
well,
you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Emotional Connection with Rafael Kushner. Our theme music is by Stephen Walters. For more information on this work, please visit my website, Living the Questions, that's plural, livingthequestions.org. This is also where you can reach me to ask questions and provide feedback, schedule your own private sessions by phone, get listings of upcoming events in your area, and learn about our unique year-long program. Once again, that's livingthequestions.org. Our second sponsor for this program is DIY Father, the choice for a new generation of fathers. Are you a brand new dad, like me? Or perhaps you're more experienced, or just found out that you're going to be a dad? If any of these descriptions fit, then please tune in to the International Dad Channel and the show DIY Father. Each week, International Dad and DIY Father present information, experiences, and news for fathers by fathers. For more information and to join in the discussion, visit internationaldad.com and DIYfather.com. That's our show for this week. Thank you for joining us, and here's to emotional connection.